Okay, again, thank you, Cecil. So I'm going to provide an overview of our ideas about using proximal sensing in field phenomics. And this has been a really wonderful collaboration among people in our laboratory, University of Arizona and Kansas State. So first, phenomics, what? A phenotype is just an observable physical or biochemical characteristic of an organism in a specific environment. So you can have, a phenotype under drought won't be the same as a phenotype under well-watered conditions. And of course, classic things would be like seed shape, seed color. It could be also quantitative things like stem height or grain yield or a thousand other characteristics. And why we're interested in this is, again, I think to meet the, there we go. You have to heave hard on the button to get, and even then it's not reliable. So we'll forget that and use the arrow. So population obviously is going to be increasing according to projections. We may be getting up to around 10 billion people by 2050. We have climate change, and then we have a lot of economic factors driving variation in prices, but with an overall trend towards increases in prices. So if agriculture is going to meet these challenges, we need some real breakthroughs in our in the way we do business. And genomics, of course, has had a huge revolution, and this has led the plant breeders and geneticists to think about studies which require much larger populations than we traditionally have dealt with. As a field physiologist, I thought a big experiment maybe had 100 genotypes, and our breeders are now talking about mapping studies where to sample what they feel is the relevant genetic variation. They're, say, saying 25 populations times 200 lines, so you're up to 5,000 genotypes. There's already a maize NAM population of this size that's resulted in a long series of interesting publications. And just as another example, the U.S. cotton community is developing a set of mapping lines, again, about 5,000 lines. And so a scenario for a field study, if you had 5,000 cotton lines, you wanted two treatments, say dry and wet, and two reps, you're up to 20,000 plots. If you just had a 4-meter long plot, which by my standards is a micro plot, you're looking at about 50 miles of actual row space to march along. It would require 20 acres, and that's excluding alleys, turnaround space, room for irrigation. So we're not going to do this with our traditional handheld or visual observations. And then the other part of this is why field-based? Why not just build some sort of a robot to do it? First is to ensure relevance to crop improvement and production. Also something I have a tremendous problem communicating this to some people is we talk about a crop. A crop is a community of plants, and the performance you see of an individual plant may bear zero or negative correlation with what you want to see under field conditions. So we really want to evaluate our plants with sort of normal competition that they would experience under field conditions. And as with this, we want to reduce potential artifacts due to soil, local microclimate. And also, I would argue that when we're getting to these very large experiments, doing them in a controlled environment is increasingly difficult. And at the same time, I don't want to exclude the potential for targeted use of controlled environments or doing other kinds of very specific measurements. So the four challenges I see in conducting these field phenomic studies, of course, what to measure in the field, so what instruments, timing, treatments, how to move the instruments over the field, how to georeference those measurements, and finally, how to analyze the data. And this symposium says primarily on how to analyze the data. Kinds of sensors we might use could be infrared thermometers to monitor canopy temperature and hopefully get inferences about transpiration or heat stress. Plant height is, elongation is very sensitive to water deficits and other stresses, so we can use an ultrasonic sensor to measure plant height. Vegetation indices, we can use an instrument such as a crop circle to get various indices related to reflectance. And we can mount the whole thing on some sort of a vehicle and use GPS to get it through the field. Just some quick examples, and this is work that Mike Gord coordinated in our laboratory before he left for Cornell. It's a set of segregating lines, and just here you can see, this looks like an aerial photography, but it's actually a composite of the tractor-based measurements. Each sort of point that you can't see is the mean of a 10-meter plot with the infrared thermometry. So the wet plots, say, are running 28 to 36 degrees, a dry plot 33 to 49. And you can also see, of course, fascinating issue, tremendous within-field variation, which is something, again, as a field physiologist, I've always suspected there are funny things going on. It's really startling when you see this in the real world. Just to show that these measurements are repeatable, this is a difference between the dry plot and the wet plot measured on two different days. So we can get some meaningful data out of these. Canopy reflectance, again, in this case, NDVI based on 820 and 670. And Mike calculated a wilting index. And again, the wilting index on one day was well correlated with the wilting index on another day. Canopy height, we can measure with ultrasonic sensors, and these are very robust industrial sensors, but they do have some interesting features that we're still trying to understand. This is a moisture gradient study, so this is from the overwatered end up to the water deficit end, and the small points are the canopy or the ultrasonic sensor measurements, and these diamonds are the actual hand measurements, just going out and looking at the tallest plants. And you can see that the overall trend is captured very well with the ultrasonic sensor. And you even pick up some things which arguably are interesting and more realistic, because as we get to water deficit, we're starting to get a very sparse canopy. And so if you're just measuring, eyeball for the maximum canopy height, you're probably biasing your measurements. And so I fitted in the quantiles for a 95th, a 75th, and a 50th percent quantile on the sensor data, and we think this is going to be a useful way to characterize not just sort of the mean canopy height, but the variation in canopy height. Image analysis, a lot of potential. It's something we are really excited about. There's a new commercial sort of consumer grade camera called the Litro Ilum with it uses a light field system, and so along with the color image, it actually produces a 3D image of height, but it turns out it has a lot of funny artifacts, and it's also not scaled. We haven't been able to relate it to an absolute height measurement. So there's a lot coming along that looks interesting. And again, we can do things with machine vision cameras to estimate NDVI on a pixel base as opposed to an average over plot. Andy French in our lab has been working with LIDAR. It looks very promising. So this would be, this is the furrow, and this is the outline of a cotton plant. He's measuring this with a sensor going through the field. And of course, there's a huge flood of new sensors for proximal sensing. Hamamatsu is advertising a spectrometer that's about the size of a quarter. Apple announces it's got a killer 3D imaging approach for a cell phone. I mentioned the Litro Ilum. A fluorescence measurement, which can be done to monitor photosystem 2, can be done remotely at a distance of 3 or 4 meters. So Kohlberg, who's now at UC Santa Cruz, developed the system. Other ones, we talk about LIDAR. A Canadian group is marketing an LED-based system that's similar to LIDAR. LIDAR equipment's been very expensive. It's another group offering a $400 LIDAR system, which we're eager to get a hold of. And, of course, this leads to a term I learned just last Thursday, which is develop paralysis, which comes when there are just too many options and you don't know which one to go with. So we'll move to something easier, vehicles. So you have the question, how to position your instruments, whatever you've got, 24/7 in the field. Obviously, we've been working with the high-clearance tractors. Andy French has been working with the helicopters. Of course, these are very expensive, but they've got some advantages, like that they work. blimps are an option, UAVs, and I think this afternoon there's a symposium on UAVs, and I noticed the first talk is about the legal aspects. Cable cameras is another one, so just a cable-mounted instrument. Of course, the tractors, lots of different versions. This is a K-State one. This is Pedro Andrade, his first tractor. This is our Avenger in Maricopa. Other people have other approaches. This is an interesting one. They have high clearance tractor to go over the fields, but they actually pack all the instruments in here and take care of the issues of illumination by having an opaque cover. A tractor is nothing but a gantry crane on rubber tires. So people are working with gantries at Erie. It's a gantry on rails. Let's see, here's a boom crane system. And Limnatech, which traditionally was known for the robotic systems in greenhouses, is also working on a gantry crane system. So move up and down the field like a giant XY plotter. So you can think about, what are the pluses and minuses? Is it a proven technology? What payload? Is it safe for crops? And for example, one of our issues with tractors is damage to the plants, capital costs, and so on. So I think there's not going to be one single solution. There's lots of different options for people, and there continue to be others. This is essentially a tethered UAV, and in theory that should get around the regulatory constraints, but I asked the FAA and they said no, it's still a UAV. Could you do something with mass and for surveillance? They've got some really impressive technology to get sensors quite high up in the air. And of course, the UAV is still a lot of issues, including that the beer delivery drone was grounded I think it was in Wisconsin or Minnesota. Then georeferencing is another problem that we need to look at. And I'll just say that GPS is providing us, I think, about 90% of the solution. We're also interested in, the inertial guidance systems. You get funny things. If you have a single GIS and it stops in the field, it can't tell which direction it's going in, and sometimes it just starts to spin. And Kansas State's, their solution is to put two GPS units on, but we think that there may be more cost-effective ways to do it. There are other options. You could tag your plots with a barcoding system or just manually register, but then at the risk of losing your throughput. Okay, so what to measure, how to move the instruments, how to georeference. Now, for the rest of it, is our take on what we want to do with the data. So we get this phenotypic data. We could just go great. So you've got plant height, you just use that directly as plant height. In DVI, you might use a regression model to estimate leaf area index. In terms of simulation modeling, the area we think shows the greatest promise is inverse modeling. And we think that, and as soon as we try and do something simple on 5,000 maze lines, we learn it isn't so easy. And I think Kelly Thorpe will be talking about this later this morning. So let's back up a little bit. So our question is really how to get, from our base phenotypic data, our plant heights or reflectance, the real question is how do we get the most biologically meaningful trait information out? And at a reasonable cost. And so for here's just an example on the cost part where you think of cost as duration, how many minutes does it take to obtain a particular measurement? These are a large range of anatomical measurements, so not really high throughput. I measured the time it took to do each evaluation in a set of 25 common bean lines, and then I looked at the F value, so essentially the power to discriminate genotypes. And what you see is that there's some measurements which are giving us good discrimination of genotypes and very rapid, and then, of course, there are other ones that may be giving us good or okay discrimination of genotypes but take much longer. So what we're looking for is to push this curve down, I guess, to the seconds level, but with very good discrimination of genotypes. And just as an example of our thinking or where we're headed, we'll work through a canopy height. Spring wheat. So traditionally, we could take measurements over time. This could be done manually or with an ultrasonic sensor. And we might say, okay, well, let's use the maximum elongation rate as a trait. And so our phenotype would be the value. Let's look at, the height at a specific day, the maximum height, or the final height. So these would all be, you know, valid phenotypes if you get into the question of which one can you measure the most accurately, which one is the highest heritability, how fast can you determine it. So first thing is, you know, from crop growth analysis, I think it's been shown that for many measurements, if you can fit a function, you can take out some of the noise, albeit perhaps sacrificing accuracy at the extremes. So the fitted curves reduce error, but your curve needs to be well well chosen. But once you have that curve, you can estimate any parameter you can think of off it. You could re-express the time component here as growing degree days, and that works well, except in this case, I just fitted it here. I actually didn't get an improvement over using days after planting with this example. But what I want to show you is, you know, we look at growing degree days and sort of think of it as a single, as a single kind of trait, but it really relates back to simulation modeling, again, the topic in this session. So if you've got, you know, a change in growth or growth rate, and you can say it's a function of some maximal rate and a function of temperature. So we've got a growth rate, a potential rate, and the function of temperature, say, scaled from 0 to 1. And this is just standard crop simulation modeling. If you integrate, you know, the rate over time, you pull the rate out of the integral, and then you can approximate that just as a summation, and lo and behold, this is how you get your growing degree days. So something like growing degree days is really analogous to running a very simple dynamic simulation model. And so this brings us then to the notion of forward and inverse modeling. Your traditional use of models, we provide known inputs, and then we predict a trait like plant height. What we're working on is what we call the inverse modeling, where you run your model, you get a prediction, you compare it to your field measurements, and from that, you improve your estimation of your cultivar-specific coefficients. And the key thing here is that your cultivar-specific coefficients could be, say, a potential maximum growth rate. That is a phenotype. And so that's really what we're driving at with the inverse modeling, is to use these as our biologically meaningful phenotypes. And then, of course, we can extend that to a wider range of measurements and possibly estimate a much larger number of phenotypes in one field exercise. And so this is why we're looking at measuring the canopy height reflectance at various reflectance at various wavelengths and thermal infrared, and hopefully bringing in image analysis further on, because we hope to be able to use the simulation model to estimate multiple plant phenotypes together in one estimation. So again, the take-home measurement I have here is that estimates of cultivar-specific model parameters are valid phenotypes. A cultivar-specific parameter for stem elongation, root elongation, photoperiod sensitivity, these are all valid phenotypes. And so finally, just close, what we see as some of the challenges for field phenomics in relation to modeling. First, there's this use of inverse modeling for data fusion. How can we work with these proxy measurements for more conventional traits? Should we incorporate an estimation of NDVI within our model, or just use NDVI to estimate something like leaf area index? How can we convert our canopy temperature into a robust estimate of transpiration? And with this, then we need to detect very small differences among thousands of plots. And with this, we run into a term called equifinality, and I hope Kelly Thorpe will pursue this a bit later. He's shaking his head, yes. Good. And then also determining the best spatial and temporal scale. So far, you know, we're just working to test the waters. We're working at the plot level and thinking primarily about daily measurements. But some people have said, maybe the most interesting genetic differences are taking place at a scale of 5 or 10 minutes or a few seconds. For instance, as the crop responds to transient changes in solar radiation or wind speed. So with that, thank you very much.
Any questions? Please come and take a seat in front. A lot of seats.
Crepe can be thought of as being a characteristic of a plant, for example.
Yeah.
It can also be thought of as a genetically determined aspect of a plant. How do you think phenolic phenology can help us distinguish those meanings of the word crepe?
Well, I would say the function or the beauty of models is that they can account for effects of environment. If I understand your question, they can factor out or filter out the effect of environment. So we'll get to traits. We should be able to get to traits which are much closer to the true sort of fundamental trait of the plant. You say, they say, get something like days to flowering. We know that has a huge environmental effect. Sensitivity or response to photoperiod is that much more fundamental trait that's directly related to the genetics. And we can use the simulation model to filter out effects of latitude, planting date. If it's responsive to water stress, perhaps we can use a water stress factor in that. So that's, I don't know if that answers your question. Yes?
So your degree data, heat unit measurements.
Yeah.
When you have canopy temperature data, one of the things you see, of course, is that your wet canopies are running much cooler than your warm canopies,
right,
which would suggest they're interacting with the thermal environment.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've calculated heat unit accumulation based on canopy temperature data,
yeah,
and compared it to that from air. Have you guys done any of that, trying to use
Not directly to the phenomics work, but I'd say, for example, we had a planting date infrared heater trial to look at temperature response of wheat, and Bruce Kimball looking at the curves of NDVI over time, and he found that he got much better sort of agreement and sort of basic responses by using a thermal time based on canopy temperature. So this again gets to the question, then, can we use just a simple radiation use efficiency model, or do we need a model with an energy balance in it? And I think increasingly, if you're looking at anything with temperature and water, I would argue you really need something with an energy balance in it as well. And 20 years ago, well, in fact, when I joined USDA 13 years ago, people were saying, oh, it's so hard to work with an energy balance because it's so computationally intensive. But now, you know, I think a cell phone can run the, run the model. Yeah.
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay, thank you.